You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And I'm stuck in a bad Scottish accent, having just watched Sapphire and Steel, Dr. McD Must Die, Adventure 5. So, this is an interesting... Oh, I got out of it. It comes and goes. Sorry. It's been doing that all day. This is a unique moment in the history of Sapphire and Steel. This is the fifth adventure, the penultimate adventure. There is but one more. And up to this point, Sapphire and Steel has been written entirely by P.J. Hammond. And this is not too uncommon in British television series, far more than it is in the United States. Let's go out on a limb and say that. That it's not uncommon that with these 6 and 8 and 10 part series that Britain produces, that sometimes you will see programs that are 100% written by a single author or a writing team of two people or... And I don't really know how the shows are commissioned. It may very well be that the writers themselves make the pitches and get the stories sold, or perhaps it's through a production company. I really don't know, but you see it a lot more often in Britain, and I think that that contributes to consistency and vision, I guess, to a show as a whole. And up to this point, Sapphire and Steel has been entirely P.J. Hammond. And in fact, when we go back to the sixth episode, it's back to P.J. Hammond. But this episode was written by Anthony Reed and Don Houghton. And as such, it's a bit different. Would that be a safe statement? I mean, it's not a hugely radical departure, but at the same time, different.
Yeah, it's slightly different in terms of story structure, certain emphasis, but a lot of the elements that make up a Sapphire and Steel story that we've seen so far, they're still there.
Absolutely. It's just like another man's take on the same thing, and clearly they must have worked in conjunction and produced it. But it just little things just seem a little bit different. Anyway, Anthony Reed and Don Houghton are both British writers of many years and many programs. Probably our listeners would most know them from their work on Doctor Who. Anthony Reed was a script editor for many, many episodes. He came after Robert Holmes and before Douglas Adams during the Tom Baker era. In fact, he is the man who suggested Douglas Adams as his replacement, and also is the man who commissioned Douglas Adams to write some Doctor Who stories. He is probably the man who most created the Key to Time, although not writing them, but he shaped the Key to Time and the character of Romana One. His actual writing episodes are not necessarily the best. He is the writer under a pen name of The Invasion of Time, and he is the writer under his own name of the much beloved Horns of Nymon, which I know is in Ben's top three favorite Doctor Who episodes, right? Caught you flat-footed on that one.
No comment. Although I would say I actually did like Invasion of Time, but that's a whole different story.
And Don Houghton has written two stories for Doctor Who. He wrote Inferno, which is one of my favorites, if a little long, but it's one of my favorites, and The Mind of Evil, which is also a Pertwee story. So what did you think of the episode, or the story? It's a six-part story, so we'll do it the story as a whole.
I enjoyed it a great deal. I've always been... Well, I don't want to go too much into a lot of specifics, but there were there were a lot of elements. And the basic wrapping for this particular story was something that I really liked. It really appealed to certain story not, I don't say story elements, but certain types of TV shows that I've seen in the past that have always been among my favorite. And well, that's basically the murder mystery.
The murder mystery. The trappings of this program is a Agatha Pistie?
Oh, good Lord.
Agatha Christie. I was trying to say Poirot. I had conflagrated Agatha Christie and Poirot in my mind. I was going to say one after the other, and then they just sort of came out together. Anyhow, it is, should we say it's set in a different time, or should we say it's set in the present?
It's essentially set in the present, but as we know with all Sapphire and Steel episodes, there is that enemy that somehow, well, not this particular enemy can play with time.
This particular enemy was named in this episode. They gave it a name. Time is
time.
The enemy.
Time is the enemy.
Time is
so
the enemy.
Time has, in this case, I don't know if they were being literal, metaphorical when they said that. Regardless, whoever the foe is in this particular episode, it turned it from being a contemporary story set in 1980 and turned it into a period piece.
In
1930 England, and it was that period piece setting that I really loved.
Okay, so the story concerns Lord Mulrain? Is
that right? Mulrain.
And,
Arthur Mulrain.
Yeah, and he is a very successful British industrialist. It is June 21st, 1980, and he is having a party to celebrate the 50th anniversary of his very successful business.
Mulrain International.
Mulrain International. And he is, for whatever reason, he is having a party that everything is going to be exactly like it was in 1930, right down to making all his clothes from totally authentic materials from 1930, having all the guests dressed that way, you know, just a 1930 shindig in celebration of his success. It's also coincidentally 50 years ago that his partner in this business died in a fire. And that's George McDee, a brilliant physicist and Scotsman, or brilliant Scotsman and physicist, depending on how you want to look at that. The people are arriving at the party, and they're marveling at the detail that they've gone through. But it's a trick. For example, one of the people comes in, and he wants to talk about, or he wants to know what's happening with, he called Boycott and his boys. That's Geoffrey Boycott, a famous British cricketer of the 80s. And turns on the old-style radio, and instead we're listening to The Ashes from 1930, Don Bradman and Brian Lara, the greats of the age, battling it out at the test at Trent Bridge. And they're all, like, amazed. How can the radio be doing that? And one of them pulls the back off, and it's a tape recorder. It's a fake. You know, so not everything is perfectly right, even though he talks about it being, the Mulrain talks about having in all the fabrics and everything perfect, but not everything is perfectly right.
Well, he's going out of his way to try and recreate the atmosphere as best as he can. And, I mean, what I found kind of astonishing was how this one guest named Felix, I believe it is.
Felix is the chief. This is a high executive in the company. Felix
right.
is the married
he,
one.
He just, for some reason, he's finding this whole thing. I don't want to say that he's looking at it with some kind of, I don't know what the word is. But he seems like he's just not in the spirit of this entire thing, and he was so desperate to expose how it was done, and then he says, all, you know, smokes and mirrors, you know, there are that smoke and mirrors, that kind of thing, you know, like desperate to reveal the magician's trick. And I kind of thought, well, okay, I mean, Lord Mulrain is doing what he can, you know, naturally you can't, unless you contact a radio station, and I don't think you're going to actually find existing recordings of good fidelity from 1930, so to...
Well, he did. Well, and I... the order doesn't really matter here, but it's interesting that later they turn the radio on, and it's a different program. And they're like, how did they get a different program? And they take the back off again, and this time, it's not a tape recorder. It's tubes. And it's an actual, real radio. Something's happening here.
Well, to make it even more interesting, I think Felix then turns to Arthur and says, well, what happened to the tape? And Lord Mulrain looks back and says, what tape?
Yeah, hard to tell whether he's playing a game or whether he's influenced by the time thing. But anyway, this is about the time Sapphire and Steel turn up as guests to the party. They've, I'm guessing, falsified invitations or done their little Jedi mind tricks or however it works. But they've shown up for the party. And unlike in previous episodes, this time they adopt false personas. Miles and Victoria Cavendish.
Virginia,
I'm sorry, that's right. To which Steele complains about the name, and then Sapphire points out that he's the one that picked it. Which is an odd piece of... And throughout the entire episode, Steele cannot remember his fake name. And so when they start to address him and he needs to use his name, you'll see him, you'll hear him mind think to Sapphire, Sapphire? And she goes, Miles.
Miles.
And then he'll cough out his name and she'll roll her eyes. And there's definitely a different interplay between them.
Well, to be fair, that's not the only thing Steele doesn't remember.
Well,
he forgets a couple of other things too, so I kind of wondered if him forgetting the name wasn't actually a key element to the story.
I think it was just for a joke. I thought it was a good joke. I mean, he just
doesn't. Well, it is kind of funny if you look at it that way, but yeah. Like I said, he does forget. There's something very important does happen later on that he does forget, and Sapphire reminds him that he had forgotten it. So maybe there's. Maybe there's a flaky memory actually going on here. That's part of the story.
Okay, we won't take this story apart spot by spot. But effectively what is happening here is that somehow time is being taken back in this room, in this part of the house, and to 1930. Whatever is trying to cause the problem is trying to take the house back to 1930 and change the course of time. Mulrain's partner, McDee, was way ahead of his time. And being the brilliant physicist he was working on genetic engineering. Not quite sure on that one, but okay.
Yeah.
And he's going to invent a vaccination to cure the world of most illnesses. But in fact, had he lived, he would have destroyed all life on Earth. Fortunately, he died on June the 22nd, 1930, the day after the partnership was formed. Whatever is doing this is using someone at the party to try to push time back, derail it, create the new timeline that destroys all life on Earth. And to do that, we spend most of the episode having everyone murdered in classic Agatha Christie fashion. One by one, the guests just keep dropping, and they keep dropping from the youngest guest to the oldest. Because
one fun little bit that was very Agatha Christie.
And then
is,
there were...
yes, there's this one elderly lady,
Felicity.
She is the widow to George McDee. Her name is Felicity. And when the first person dies, she says, "And then there were nine. And then there were eight." And so it's like right out of an Agatha Christie story. I thought it was a fun little homage. It was cute.
It was definitely what is the word? Pastiche.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, one dead body has a big old knife out of their back. I mean,
it looked terrible.
It's like, in my world, I'm going...
Exactly.
And one guy is shot. Another
something
is,
that looks like a cap gun.
Another one is poisoned with cyanide while giving a toast at the dinner table. Another electrocuted on the doors, on the handles of the doors. And, of course, as soon as they die, shortly thereafter, their bodies disappear, and then people start to forget that they were there. They're getting things jumbled up in their minds. They're forgetting things. They periodically get swept up in the whole notion that they're really in 1930. And then sometimes they get swept back. And, of course, in classic murder mystery style, we have, let's see, I see signs that the boss, Mulrain, is having an affair with his secretary. And he is about, I don't know, what, 2'2"?
He's like Toulouse Lautrec.
He's a little guy. And his secretary is this giant redhead, which is quite funny. But he looks short compared to everybody. Then he's got his sister, who was obviously having an affair with his partner. And, of course, his partner's widow. And then his business associate is there, younger business associate, and his wife, and that's Vanessa, and she's having an affair with McDee's grandson. And then they've got their banker there, who's an even younger man, and he's brought in a young lady, but he's having an affair with Mulrain's secretary for sure. I'm not 100% positive about Mulrain and the secretary, but definitely the banker and the secretary.
You got a couple of the names mixed up, but that's okay.
Did I?
Yeah. The youngest guy.
The youngest guy is the banker.
Mentioned, that, his name is Tony Purnell. It's his date that is named Vanessa.
It's his date, Vanessa. Then what is the...
Annabelle.
Annabelle. Yeah, right.
Annabelle is the wife.
They're all just murder fodder.
Howard. Yeah. But Howard is the grandson to George McDee.
No. He's not married. Howard's not married.
Oh, you're right. It's Felix.
Felix is married.
And his wife is Annabelle.
And she's having an affair with Howard.
She's having the affair with Howard, who was the grandson to...
George McDee. But they keep calling him Malcolm, because that's his dad's name, and he's a spitting image of his dad. And as time is slipping, they keep confusing him with his son. So if you aren't confused now, go watch the episode and try to keep those names straight in your head. Ben's doing a much better job of it than I am. But, I mean, there is just animosity and reason for people to commit murder all over the place.
It is really right out of an Agatha Christie story. Everybody has a motive.
Pretty much. That's right. And, basically everyone has a motive to kill somebody in that room. And there's another piece that keeps showing up that's bizarrely weird. George McDee.
Yeah, just all of a sudden.
He'll walk into the room and he'll talk to people, and some of the people will be like thinking it's a trick, you know, like in poor taste to have Mulrain hire an actor come in and play it. And then other people just treat it like it's really George. And
Lord Mulrain, Arthur, is completely shocked by seeing this person looking like George. Emma is horrified and calls the whole thing to be in bad taste, and yet Felicity completely buys into it. She actually believes that it's George. She seems to think it's 1930 all over again, and when she goes up to him, he doesn't even recognize her because he's looking at an old – he's looking at Felicity
50 years
later. She is in 1980. I mean, a woman that's 50 years older than the wife he would have had back in 1930. I mean, so anybody listen to this, if this sounds confusing, it's because it is confusing.
It is confusing. And there's also a door.
A door that keeps changing.
The door that keeps changing. It's a door to Mulrain's office, Lord Mulrain's office, and it's a green security door that can only be opened with a remote control, which he has inconveniently forgotten. It's on the other side is his redhead secretary and their computers and his business, but she's been left with strict instructions not to disturb them. But the door wasn't there in 1930.
Because when we would see the door change,
then you'd know it was a door
green
to the
door to a regular door. We would then know that on the other side, if it was just a regular door, on the other side it was George's
laboratory. Right.
Every time it was a green door, it was Lord Mulrain's office.
And it has no door handle, so you can't get through it. So it would transform. People would walk through it. They'd go into the office. So Sapphire and Steel are trying to figure out, you know, it's using somebody, but they don't know who it's using. And, of course, it's killing people, but they're not really all that interested in solving the mystery of who's being killed. And they also point out that people aren't really dead anyway. They're just gone off the limbo or something because their bodies disappear. And
it's like they're being removed from time because as
they're not alive yet.
Well, they weren't alive in 1930, so they could not have been at
From
what I gather, there actually was a party on June 21st, 1930. And
yes.
Where the partnership was signed between Lord Mulrain and George McDee, and that this party in 1980 is to commemorate. I mean, so that's why there's another party going on. I think. I think that's why they're going for the theme party, to try and sort of recreate the party that did happen back in 1930.
Which, considering it led to the death of George McDee, is a bit in bad taste. However, well, there's more to it than that. Lord Mulrain wouldn't know that.
No, he wouldn't.
He just thought the man died in a fire.
But what's happening is when these people, when we have our murder victims, first we see them die. Then we see them. Then we don't see them at all. They just disappear, and we find out later.
And the older people forget them first.
Yeah, the older people forget who they are, and then as Steele will later reveal, and I don't think I'm really giving anything away at this point by saying it, they're being taken out by time because they weren't born at the time of June 21st, 1930. So they're being kind of – it's like being surgically removed. You know, if this were Doctor Who, you would call it a time scoop.
Yeah. And they're also Sapphire and Steel point out that the entity, the time entity, is having to deal with them on two different levels. It's having to deal with them as Sapphire and Steel and as Miles and Virginia Cavendish, which I don't know why that's confusing, but there you
go. Sapphire seems to think would give them their biggest advantage.
Yes, and it can take over them because at one point it gets into Sapphire's consciousness, and she tries to kill herself with the knife. But fortunately, Steel puts his hand there, and the knife can't go through it. But then he is
Steel.
So you'd think he wouldn't be too worried when then she turns around with a gun and tries to shoot him with it. But they get out of that. Say no more, kind of thing. There's also, you know, other things. They're talking about the fact that this is June 21st, which
summer
is the
solstice,
right? And that the house was built on a ley line, and none of that really seems to go anywhere. It's just
they kind of surmise that these are elements which are playing into time doing what it's doing.
Yeah, it's just sort of like extra pieces that make this spot unique in this house.
It's like a weak spot in the space-time fabric.
Right.
Sort of.
So I think we don't need to go into the resolution of this story. Suffice to say that George McDee was indeed murdered, and someone there had reason to murder him, and Sapphire and Steel managed to get him murdered again. Which is kind of weird, but I
necessary when you consider that
all life
had
on
he
Earth.
Lived, he would have been extremely careless and would have released a mutated virus that would have wiped out all life on Earth.
Which is a heck of an achievement. That's why you don't let physicists do genetic engineering in 1930 before it's been invented.
Exactly.
Just my thoughts on that, but that's why you should stick to your own discipline. He should have been trying to invent an atomic bomb or something.
Yeah.
Which probably would have been more appropriate for his skills. I want to talk about Sapphire and Steel's odd relationship in this episode.
Yeah, I saw some interesting things in this one. There was one very interesting moment where we see some tenderness from
some lip lock in there too.
So well, Sapphire, she starts caressing the side of Steel's face, and then they move in towards a kiss, just as they're being rudely interrupted by Emma, who was calling them to dinner. Well, I guess they were kissing.
Yes, I mean, wasn't tongues on panting kind of stuff, but I mean, they were.
But there was contact.
Yes, there were several occasions where I don't know if it was part of them playing the part of a married couple, where Sapphire would reach over and take Steel's hand, or he would, or this time when they're actually talking in their minds about the case, and while they're talking in their minds of the case, they're just getting closer. Sapphire is just pulling in closer, and they start kissing, and then Emma walks through and interrupts them. Of course, she's not scandalized or anything. She's, that's where you two got to.
Gee, I wonder why she isn't scandalized.
Yeah. And so they've definitely got something going on there, and I think this is one of the things that makes this Anthony Reed, Don Houghton script interesting, is that it lends a new facet to Sapphire and Steel that has only been occasionally hinted at, like in the episode in the apartment complex where Sapphire is kind of caressing Steel's hand when they're on the ledge of the building, and she's just kind of held him in place, kind of thing, where we just see these little moments. This one has more of them in it, and it also has more interaction with them about, like, when she's playing bridge and, you know, Steel's like, why didn't you come? I said, we bid seven diamonds.
Yes.
And you can't tell whether or not that's because her mind's being influenced or whether or not she just didn't need to respond at that point. But then she goes on, it's like, you've never played bridge, have you? It's just sort of this little bantery kind of exploration of each other.
Well, it seems like, especially on the case of Sapphire, we've kind of gotten a sense in the past that she was at least more willing or more open to the idea of kind of losing herself to the moment, depending on the setting.
And if she liked the moment a lot, she could take time back.
Right.
But
Steel, of course, being the Steel that he is, not wanting to go down those roads. But this time, it really seemed a much stronger
bond
trail than we'd ever seen come from her before.
Yeah, they definitely seem to be together. We also get a little information about them.
Oh, yes, we do.
Yes, we do. They finally explain themselves to Felix, the last surviving post-1930 person. And Steel tells him who they are, that we are actually Sapphire and Steel, and he gives them some explanation, kind of off-camera. And when we come back and join them again, he's like, so you're like some sort of interplanetary police force.
This is of a sort.
Of a sort. Are you aliens? Of the extraterrestrial kind?
In an extraterrestrial sense, yes.
Yes. So we're now pretty clear that Sapphire and Steel are extraterrestrial, but that doesn't mean they're not humans. Know what I mean?
It's kind of a strange, it's a very ambiguous response. In an extraterrestrial sense, Yes.
That just means you come from somewhere other than this.
Yeah, in response to, are you aliens? In an extraterrestrial sense, yes. I found that to be a rather... It's slightly cryptic.
There's a lot of weird things going on in this, and I think the writers were having fun. I think they'd watched the other episodes and said, "Here's some we can just kind of throw in weird stuff in here." And
there's plenty of weird stuff. We actually see
it's more playful episode. How about that?
It is a bit more playful on both their parts. We also get to see more talent in terms of what they can do. Now, for me, this is the first time I remember Sapphire being able to, and for lack of a better term, astral project.
Yes. Yes. And we see a lot more of them teleporting.
Yes. And Steel, well, both of them demonstrate telekinesis.
Yes, or well, are they? Do we see telekinesis, or do we see them actually teleport objects? I mean, he'll have something underneath his hand, and it's like,
Sapphire turns a key that's in a lock.
Yeah, okay.
So she does that, and as far as what Steel is doing, I don't know if you want to call it so much telekinesis, but he's standing in front of a computer, and he's making a circular pattern with his finger, almost as if it was like a remote control, if you will.
Yeah.
For
That's
the
true.
Computer, so he's having the computer display all these the records on what happened to the mansion in 1930. What was the nature of the fire? Where did the fire happen? And basically, because he's trying to find out how George
McKee
actually die.
Right.
And so it's like he's scrolling.
I wanted to mention that scene because I thought that scene had something in it that was enormously out of place. So they're in 1930, and basically that's what we're presented, that they have truly that room and that wing of the house has been pushed back into 1930 for real. They can't go out the door. They can't go out the windows. Everything's sealed up tight, and everything in the place is now genuinely, authentically 1930s, and they need to get to the computer system in 1980, and Sapphire kind of volunteers that she can do that, and Steela, you could never, because we know she can't move time very far.
That far,
50 years far, but she does it. She manages to pull it for 50 years, and the door shifts from the wooden door to the green security door. Steel goes through, tries to get the information from the secretary, and fails miserably. So he goes back and he gets Sapphire and has Sapphire go in and try. And Sapphire, I need some feminine wiles, I believe he says.
Yeah, and she plays towards the secretary's vanity.
Her clothes.
About her clothes and how she buys them.
Oh, you must be ever so clever to buy it. I could never do stuff like that, that kind of thing. While Steel is doing the computer hacking thing by remote control behind her. And when they leave, the secretary looks over at the computer, sees what's on the screen. She's that bitch!
Yeah. I thought, okay, I didn't expect that.
That felt totally out of place.
It did.
In that episode. But it was odd.
It was I don't know if shocking is the right word, but I was certainly surprised by it.
I liked the episode quite a bit. I think it probably could have been 4 episodes instead of 6. And all they had to do there is just bring a couple less guests to the party. Because a lot of it is really just kind of killing time waiting for the next murder. They're not really... Sapphire and Steel are not really figuring anything out at all as this episode goes along. Pretty much to the point where Sapphire goes through the door and they get the computer information. They're really not, they're just kind of watching.
Yeah, they're really playing observers a lot. I will actually differ from you on this one. While I tend to not care for the six-part episodes. I actually think this one kind of worked. Yes, there was a lot of story. Well, I don't want to say a lot of story. There was a lot of story that was being told. Whether it needed to be told or not, that's arguable. But what I think our writers were trying to do is I think they approached it with the idea of wanting to do a period Agatha Christie-style murder mystery. And one of the best ways to do that is you start off with a big group of people. It doesn't work so well when you start off with a little. You need a big group. That way you can it's supposed to create a bit more suspense, especially in this particular case, as people start dying a bit at a time. I think their intention, whether they succeeded or not, again, is arguable. But I think their intention was to, by having people die one at a time, is to ratchet up that suspense and to really, by this point, really have a lot of finger pointing going on at the same time as you're trying to build up to the resolution as to why is it so important that George McDee must – well, not so much why, but how did he die?
Yeah, I was going to say, we know from very early.
Yeah, I know. But what is going to happen? How we really don't know how he died.
Right.
And what was the event? That's the one thing that Steele is desperately trying to figure out. He wants to find the moment. And we're given several red herrings that even fool Sapphire. She thinks this is it. Oh, that's not
nope,
it.
That wasn't
it. It should have been it.
That's right. Enough people wanted George McDee dead. Apparently at that moment.
He wasn't very likable.
Well, no. Do you not understand me? Leave me alone! Just shouting at everybody who comes in his office and cranky.
Yeah.
And now, but here's the thing about the suspense and the tension and the Agatha Christie-esque nature of this story. I would agree with you that you are ratcheting up the suspense as you kill the people off in a story such as this. That is absolutely true. There's just one little problem with that. We are basically told by Sapphire or by Steele that these people aren't being killed, and we're being told that they're not really trying to solve the killings, to stop the killings, because they're not really being killed, and we're also presumably, it's pretty obvious once they mention the fact that they're going from the youngest to the oldest, that they're trying to get rid of everyone who was not alive in 1930, which means there's a finite end to this, and that we won't find out what's happening until we reach that point. So the suspense is blown away by the fact that we know these murders are going to occur, we know who it is who's going to die, and not die, but be removed from the picture. So it kind of takes away from the suspense to me that I don't think anybody's really in that much peril. They've kind of tipped their hand a little too early here who the survivors are going to be in.
Maybe a little bit, but again I would say that in terms of okay, I'm trying to play the story back in my head because I actually just saw this part tonight, within the last 2 hours. If I recall correctly, what had happened when Sapphire and Steele finally make the big reveal, and they do it to Felix because he, as we find out, is the last one who is in line to be killed, for lack of a better term. The big reveal we find out is that time is taking people out who were not alive in 1930. Okay, and it's at this point in the story that the focus is now changed.
Well, they tell that at least when Annabelle is still alive.
Well, a little bit, but then they also kind of backtrack when Sapphire says that, I think it was Sapphire and Steele. They were having the conversation that as Sapphire and Steele, they were going to try and solve this temporal problem that was being presented. But as Miles and Virginia, they would attempt to solve the murder mystery.
I do believe that there's supposed to be some sort of notion that the person who was helping the time entity is responsible for the murders, but actually, we never see that.
And you're right. That is a disappointment.
And it's never revealed as to whether or not...
It is not revealed. In fact, we are given a huge red herring that it is Emma that's sort of behind it. And her behavior is very erratic throughout much of this story. I mean, sometimes she's very lucid and is just horrified by what's going on. But as the story progresses, she just gets loonier and loonier.
She seems to be the one that goes back to 1930 mode the fastest, I think, over the others. I mean, Felicity initially starts off that way, but probably by episode 4, she's pretty much just in the 90s. I mean, when Howard dies in front of her, he has a toast and then he pitches forward on the table, and
by that point, she doesn't even know that he's there.
She knew he was there because she was complaining about his toast too. But when he pitches forward, so I say, is he drunk? Is he gone a bit squiffy? And then Felix says, I'm afraid he's dead. Oh, the tablecloth. And then she ignores it, and then she forgets he's there.
At the moment when it's announced, when George says, I'm afraid he's dead, it's almost as if at that point the memory of Howard was just removed.
Oh, look, someone spilled wine on the table. A port
Pour
on the table.
Pour some salt on there so that it won't stain. And then you see her and Arthur having some fun with some fruit. As Emma is showing Howard the very same little example of the summer solstice that Steele showed Emma earlier in this story.
So, by
this time she's gone.
She's gone, and she seems to be the first to be completely gone. But the old people forget them, and it's only the people who are post 1930 that are like horrified about this murder. That's the point where Steele reveals
Felix
they're going to take everybody.
Felix begins to forget too.
Yes, a little bit. That's right. They all do. Everyone, even Sapphire and Steele do periodically in this episode. So that's.
It's a very powerful little enemy here. I mean, if he can affect the memory of both Sapphire and Steele and affect their behavior, I mean, he's made a pretty strong stuff. But we are kind of led to believe that he is working through.
Yes.
One of those people. And it's never really brought to fruition.
Well, it is. In other words, towards the end, we are the person. There is a person who was tricked by time. That's exactly what it. The person was promised something. If time got rewritten, they were promised something would be different than the way it was, and that they wanted very desperately. And so they went along with this. Then Sapphire and Steele talk this person into believing that time tricked them, and George McDee talks this person into believing that they can't allow time to be changed. So yes, absolutely, there was one person throughout the whole story who was working, who had helped to bring this through. Time definitely tricked this person. And we won't say who it is.
I never bought off
that this person was committing the murders.
That's my point. I didn't get off on that either. I wasn't fully convinced that this person managed to do all this fancy wiring which caused the electrocution of Annabelle.
That's why I say it's disjointed, because it is spelled out explicitly at the end that this person was doing it, but they never did the murder.
There is one really cryptic murder that I found, not a cryptic murder, but there's a very cryptic scene that makes you kind of take a step back and think, what is exactly happening here? It's much earlier on where they're playing a game. It's called Sardines.
Mm.
It's sort of a little bit like, I guess, hide and seek.
I have no idea, and I didn't look it up, but I'm going to have a guess that the game is played like this. It's hide and seek, and when you find the person, you hide with them until you're all packed in like sardines.
A can of sardines. Yes, because at one point, now our first murder victim is
Vanessa.
The young date, to our youngest banker, Tony Purnell, and Vanessa. She's hiding in a closet. And it is Annabelle who finds her. And she makes the comment, oh, can I fit in there?
Right.
Before she realizes that...
she's dead.
That
with a big knife.
With the tip of the knife only impaled into the back.
That's right. The knife's only impaled in about a quarter of an inch, but this knife is about a foot long.
I know. It's got to be one huge knife. There's one really strange scene that happens after that. Tony is back in his room.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, somebody opens up the door. He turns around. We don't see who it is, but we see a silhouette or
and then
shadow
a flash of light.
The floor. And then, the regular lights dim, and then he is just washed in this blue light, and he just backs up against the wall and is flipped out from that point.
And then found dead.
Until we find him dead later.
Oh, no, wait a minute. We did not find him dead later.
Well, no, we didn't. Well, we find him in the dining room. Or
scared.
At least he's scared to death.
And he wants to talk to Steele. Or
the butler Gravel finds him hiding behind a curtain, and he says, I want to talk to Miles, and only Miles, nobody else. So Gravel goes out to get Steele, and when they go back in there, they hear Tony
a shot.
Sitting at the table with a fatal gunshot wound to his chest.
Right.
But the question still is, what happened
in
to
the
Tony
room.
In his room.
And don't we see his room trashed out later?
His room is really trashed.
So what's that about? Were
none
they searching
is,
for
none
something?
None of that is explained.
No, or makes any sense. Is somebody looking for something? Is there a secret that somebody's trying to find? Don't know. Never addressed.
It's never addressed.
I think we should get down to brass tacks, though.
Oh.
So Felix is the last to go. Poor old Phoenix, his wife's just been killed by electrocution. Although that's not before he took some time to play a bit of... Well, he's going to go off and play some bridge. That's before he played bridge.
Bridge plays after.
That's right, bridge plays after. And he's all worried that he's going to be killed. Fair enough. And they try to convince him that, oh, it's not that bad. And they bring back Howard. Sapphire is able to pull him back from wherever he is. And he talks about how nice warmth. Like, I'm floating around and I can... right now, I'm watching when I was in second grade or something like that. And to get him to prove it, he tells him what the color of the lining of his sock drawer is.
It's the drawer where he keeps his shirts.
Yeah, something. And you know, it's not bad. Don't worry about it. It's quite nice, really. I'm having a lot of fun up here. And... one, to try to convince him that something really bizarre is going on. More so than, you know, because they don't really believe this crazy story of Sapphire and Steel. Or he doesn't believe this crazy story of Sapphire and Steel's. And then they explain... that's when they tell him their actual names. And he... Sapphire... they say, we need your help. Or Steele says this to him. We need your help here. And Sapphire puts her hands on him and gives him the ability to communicate with them in the mind. And he takes on the name of Brass.
Well, the funny thing is he then says, do I get a name? Because he asks if there are others.
Yes.
Of their kind. And he says, oh, yes, there's yeah. bronze, there's silver, there's lead. And he says, well, who am I? Platinum? Diamond? And then he says, with great reservation, tin?
Tin?
And at that point, Sapphire says, how about brass? Now, I had to admit, I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
Given the way he's kind of behaving and all of this, you know, he's being a little brassy. And I thought, brass? Well, okay, yeah, that kind of works.
So...
yes, then she gives him this gift.
She gives him the power, and Steele sends him off to talk to the butler to find out how old he is, to see if the butler is one of the people who's gonna die. And then they have a little conversation. First off, Steele kind of chastises Sapphire for giving him that power. And she says, oh, I only gave him first level one power.
Do you really think he can help us?
No.
I just wanted to give him something to do to keep him from worrying.
Get him out of the way.
Until he dies, is what he's basically saying.
Well, Steel is being his typical Steel. I'm just getting him out of the way. He's not really going to die.
Yeah, but he needs to be murdered, quote unquote, for this story to finish.
In order for this whole thing to play out.
Right. And so they're just distracting him for now. And there's quite a funny scene where they are playing bridge, and Steel is trying to get to talk to
Sapphire's attention,
and she appears to be not hearing him, but Brass can hear, and so he and Steel have an amusing little conversation there while he's trying to do mind thinking and do the bridge game, and you know, not react to Steel speaking out loud, and it's funny. I mean, there's more humor in this episode. Like I say, the whole episode is more playful than any of the P.J. Hammond stories that we've seen, which have not been playful at all, frankly. I like that. I really would love to have seen, not to take anything away from P.J. Hammond, but these guys were able to do weird just as weird as he was able to do weird. And
but interject just the right amount of humor.
Yeah, what would other people have done with Sapphire and Steel? And I know that Big Finish Productions have done Sapphire and Steel audio dramas, which I have not. I've heard a bit of one of them. But you know, that this seems like a missed opportunity here. That maybe in this case, maybe P.J. Hammond should have let others get a little bit of crafting of Sapphire and Steel in the...
Yeah, I think so.
So we got anything else on this episode? All I can say for sure is that George McD must die. That's important.
Well, Dr. McD.
Oh, you're right. It is Dr. McD. It's Dr. McD. Must die. That is the unofficial name of this story.
Yes. I don't know if we want to give the big reveal.
No, I don't think it's really necessary in this case. I mean, it's for such a poorly constructed mystery, which it is a poorly constructed mystery.
The resolution
was not what I expected.
Well, really? I had it. I had this person pegged.
I had it down to one of the two people that would have been involved there, but
the actual dramatic element?
Yeah, as to which one was that did the murder back in those days, and it was a murder, I will say. It just happens that there was a fire that burned the body, and so that the murder has been
got covered up.
Covered up, and only the two people, the final two people who were involved, were in the room. And obviously they both know it was murder. And they've been at this party, and they've obviously been around each other for 50 years after that murder, if you think about it.
I did find that a little peculiar, although there is a very strange line earlier on when one of them says to the other, "Remember, I know everything."
Yeah, I guess that could have been.
So, I guess they, at some point, they were able to come to maybe some kind of uneasy, civilized truce. But at the end of the day,
they weren't very civilized to each other, though.
No, there was a lot of, although there was one very amusing moment of singing between the two, although that might have been when they were both
pre-murder.
They were in the they're in a 1930 pre-murder mode. But as far as the murder itself, what brought it about, there were several clues which I was able to pick right out.
Oh, I knew that the murder had to do with his affairs, and that it was going to be it was going to be a spurned woman, or it's going to be a woman, one way or the other. I mean, that was pretty clear. This was a jealousy murder.
I thought. But I couldn't tell which one it was going to be. Now, that was the bottom line. Because I didn't get anything out of the story that told me which one it was. You know, it could have been either way. I think that if they'd turned it and done it the other way around and had the other person kill it, I think we'd be sitting here saying, you know, I think you'd be sitting there saying, well, I knew that was coming all along. Well, it's like, you know, I can't disprove that, and I...
Well, you make a good point. You make a good point. I would say that the person that did do it was my first guess. But I agree. If I were allowed a second guess, I would have thought it was the other person. Just like you did.
The
you
one know, I didn't think it was.
One of these two people.
The one I didn't think it was, and I guess we'll go out since we now have said it's a woman. I didn't think it was Mulrane. At any time, I never thought it was Mulrane.
No, and I
then,
didn't either.
And then we get right up to where they finally reach the point where they're recreating the 1930 day of his murder. Now, once we hit midnight and everybody's dead and it's 1930, June 22nd, 1930, now everyone is acting it out in the household, oblivious to everything. They are just simply recreating the day.
They are reliving that day.
They don't even see Sapphire and Steel anymore. They're just standing around watching them and teleporting around and watching what's happening, going on. And that is the first point where something comes up. Well, then we see the big drama blow up. And then we see the point, all of a sudden, Mulrane actually has a motive for murder. And in fact, kind of comes close to committing murder on that evening. But there really wasn't anything throughout the entire story that said that there was, you know, that I thought he was going to be the killer.
No.
So that one was a red herring there, but right at the end, and if they had
made him the killer, that really would have thrown me for a loop.
If they'd made some hints that he had reason to want him dead,
which there were none.
There really weren't any. I mean, obviously, we're told that Mulrane. Obviously, he's a brilliant businessman because for 50 years he's run this company and made a fortune. So it's not like he's resting on the laurels of Dr. McD. It's just that. And so we never got anything along the way that said that he had any motive for it. And in fact, I'm not even convinced that he got anything from McD, because if the story plays out this right, on the 21st, McD signed over all of his inventions and any future things. And it's the future things that they're banking on making them rich.
Right.
But he dies before and destroys all of his stuff. Therefore, did Mulrane even get anything out of this partnership other than, you know, a one-day dead partner? He's had a partner for one day, and he's dead.
I don't think he got anything at all.
If there'd been some indication that he was filthy rich or something, and that money had transferred into the business or something like that, but we're never really given that. So,
no.
Mulrane's not much of a red herring. At all in this story. So that was another kind of weak element to the mystery aspect of this story.
And by saying that it's not Mulrane, and that by also saying that the killer is a woman, it pretty much only leaves you with two people.
It's between Felicity and
Emma.
And it's one of them. And
it's one of them, and I had one of them pegged at
first. One was his wife, and one was his lover.
Right.
You know,
I will admit, I had one of them figured out. My first guess was the right one, but they did get me to second guess myself at one point, and I started thinking,
okay,
there
but
is good motive for it to be the other lady.
Yes, they both had.
They both had motive,
and not only. Did they both have motive, but in the end it turned out that the person who killed George wasn't trying to kill George.
No.
Was trying to kill the other woman.
Right.
So and they both had motive to want the other woman dead.
Yeah.
So, you know, that
George
doesn't,
simply got in the way.
Yeah, he was trying to stop it. And stopped a bullet instead. Unless you have anything else specific about this episode.
Just a general wrap-up. I thought this was a very enjoyable story. For me personally, the pacing was pretty good. It's a story that you cannot watch it casually. You really have to pay attention the entire time. I liked some with past shows that we've podcasted on. In many cases I could multitask, do several things while I'm watching the episode, you know, taking down my notes and be okay. I couldn't do it with this one. I had to be completely glued in front of the TV, computer or my iPad in hand, typing the notes as I'm watching it without distraction, because there's just so much going on here. And a lot of it is window dressing.
Yes.
It's not necessarily something that is going to that plays a pertinent part to the story. It is window dressing. But, oh, it's such wonderful window dressing. Yes. And it was for me. I mean, it just – this story really had a lot of bells and whistles to it that I really enjoyed a great deal.
The funny thing about the idea of it being window dressing is I think that it is central to the conceit of the story that they had to do the window dressing to achieve the transfer.
The desired effect.
Yes. So, yes, it's window dressing, and we don't necessarily need to see them doing this stuff with a radio or listening to the cricket announcing or the playing the bridge or any of those sort of things, or the ritual of passing the port to the left or anything like that. It's just that these people are being steeped and swept up, and they're generating, by their involvement, they're generating the power or whatever you want to say to make this movement. So,
to help move the house back in time.
So that's as good as excuse as any to force us to have a lot of detail in the story. So I
agree with that. It was a fun, very enjoyable story for me. Unfortunately, the criticisms that I've got, the mysterious blue light on Tony, unexplained, and the opening seemed a little slow getting it started. But there's again, as you pointed out, and as I've said, there's a lot of window dressing here. There's a lot of pieces that need to be set into place. So yeah, you got to take your time to set your players up. And unfortunately, that's the slowest part of this entire thing. But once Sapphire and Steel show up, by the time you get to the end of the first episode, you're in, and it becomes a fun roller coaster ride.
Well, I think that's it for our coverage of Sapphire and Steel 5. Dr. McD Must Die. Next week, we should be back with another exciting episode of The Star Lost. And I hope you will join us all again then on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fusionpatrol, or look for us on Facebook. Fusion Patrol is a production of Lone Locust Productions. Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.